Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Greg Bluestein, filling in today for Bill Nygut. Thanks for joining us. A reminder that you can log in to the GPB News Facebook page right now and not only hear us, but you get to see us too. We'll monitor your comments there, and you can also comment on our Twitter page, @PoliticsGPB. Let's meet today's guests. Andra Gillespie is a professor of political science at Emory University.
Hey, Greg.
Hey, good morning. And next to her is political science professor Audrey Haynes, who made the trip all the way from UGA in Athens. Hey, professor.
And on spring break, too.
And on spring break. You could have been at the beach, but here you are.
Yes.
To my right is Karen Owen, also a political science professor. She's from the University of West Georgia in Carrollton.
Good morning.
Good morning. And Alan Abramowitz is a political science professor at Emory.
Good morning.
Good morning. So later we'll talk about the latest developments with coronavirus, including a call to delay crossover day tomorrow. But first, let's get right into it and start with last night's major news. Joe Biden wins Mississippi, wins Missouri, wins Michigan, the biggest prize of the night. He wins Idaho. He picks up Andrew Yang's endorsement. Washington's still close, too close to call, but Bernie Sanders picks up North Dakota. So what do you guys think? Is this thing effectively over?
It's certainly getting there. I mean, I think we have to acknowledge, you know, the fact that losing Michigan was a big psychological blow to Bernie Sanders. Biden has shown that he can win in different regions in the country. So this isn't just a Southern thing. It isn't just African-American voters propping him up. And so, you know, as Biden widens his lead, it's a tougher case for Bernie Sanders to say that, you know, he should stay in or that he's still viable.
And he didn't, because he didn't talk last night.
He did not talk last night, Professor Abramowitz. I mean, that was stunning for him because candidates usually try to take up any opportunity they can to go in front of live TV cameras.
You think he would have wanted to reassure his supporters.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, he went back to Vermont. Presumably, he's meeting with his campaign advisors. And, we may hear something later today about whether he's going to continue on to next week and to the debate on Sunday or whether this is the end. And you know, the interesting last night was not just that Biden won those states, especially Michigan, but that the margins were very big.
Mm-hmm.
Washington State looks close, but Michigan was a blowout. Mississippi was a huge blowout. Missouri was a blowout. And so Biden's picking up the vast majority of the delegates that were awarded or being awarded from those states, which already gives him a big lead in the delegate count.
Yeah, Professor Owen, I mean, Michigan was supposed to be the crucial, this is the state that helped Bernie Sanders revive his campaign 4 years ago against Hillary Clinton, and it was called the moment almost as soon as the polls closed there.
And he was able to capitalize on white working class in Michigan, and that did not happen yesterday for him. And so I think he is having to evaluate how is he appealing to that group? Can he continue on to try to appeal, or is this all now for Biden?
So what is next? Because at this point, he has built a coalition of working class voters, of African American voters, but he's still struggling to get those young voters, Professor Gillespie.
And you saw him do this a little bit last night. In his speech, he tries to reach out to Bernie supporters to say, you are part of this coalition. I hear you. I listen to you. I care. It's going to take a little more cajoling in this group. I think it's also important for us to realize and contextualize where young voters kind of fall in this. So this is the lowest turnout group. And the group that is turning out have the highest intensity and a lot of activism. They're not necessarily completely reflective of their entire generation. And so long term, you know, while I expect that younger people are going to be more liberal sort of, you know, in 10, 15 years from now compared to those of us who are at that stage of life now, I think we also have to just be really careful about like not extrapolating too much from, you know, the really small percentage of, you know, highly motivated young activists who are out there. But Biden's going to reach out to them. Biden's going to definitely, because he can't win without progressive voters.
And Joe Biden tried to thread that needle last night at a party in Philadelphia after his earlier planned scheduled party was canceled because of coronavirus. Let's take a listen to what he said.
To all those who have been knocked down, to all those who have been counted out, left behind, this is your campaign. Just over a week ago, many of the pundits declared that this candidacy was dead. Now we're very much alive.
And he also tried to appeal to some of Bernie Sanders' supporters at the same event.
We need you, we want you, and there's a place in our campaign for each of you. And I want to thank Bernie Sanders and his supporters for their tireless energy and their passion. We share a common goal, and together, we'll defeat Donald Trump. We'll defeat him together.
So it's kind of a, you heard the applause at the end there, but it was not your typical boisterous campaign rally. It was much more sobering, right? Don't you think, Professor Haynes?
Yes, that's because they realize that they're at a very important point in the campaign where, you know, this is pivotal strategically for both sides. So he needs to make sure that he is a focused on message and to work a little bit harder on delivering what that message should be, because right now, as we were talking about earlier, Bernie has to also make a point. This is a strategic point for him. It's not just about deciding whether he's going to go on or whether he is going to stay in. It's what is the value of this movement that he's created? What is his contribution going to be? Strategically, can he get anything out of this moment? Because if he fizzles in the rest, and we've talked about the calendar, it's not a great calendar for him at this point. So what's he going to do? This is a chance right. for him to optimize the value of his campaign.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that for Biden also in the next couple of weeks, it's going to be interesting to see if he makes some moves in terms of trying to offer some policy concessions, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the vice presidential nomination will be very important in this regard, picking someone who would appeal to some of the Sanders supporters. But I think taking some positions or clarifying some of his positions on issues that are especially important to Sanders and his supporters, he really does need to make sure he has their enthusiastic support going into the general election.
Andrew?
I mean, I think the part that's really tough about this is what kind of leverage does Sanders get? As a second place, finisher, he does have some leverage and can shape policies and platforms. He did that in 2016 very effectively. I mean, the Democratic Party is much farther left now than it was back then, in part because of his candidacy. But because this candidacy is not shaping up to be as successful as the previous one, and then also in part because of the successes of 2016, yeah, there are new things on the horizon like Medicare for All, even though we were talking about single payer options well before, 2016, and the Green New Deal that, could kind of be up for negotiation. It's a question of, well, what other things could Bernie Sanders possibly get at this point, which might actually end up sort of hastening sort of his exit from the race, because, Sanders got a lot of what he got because he basically refused to concede. So, yeah, I'm just wondering how this plays out, because he's already had the successful leverage candidacy. So it's a question of, well, what do you do now?
Yeah, I mean, he has a hard power of endorsement and policy, but he also has that soft power because, as we saw in 2016, a lot of his supporters didn't end up, not a lot, but some of his supporters didn't end up backing Hillary Clinton.
And we can't neglect to think about how much Bernie Sanders can raise money. Mm-hmm. And he has a long list of donors, and Biden needs that. And I think it's very important that we think about not only the policy part, but is Sanders willing to come to the table with the Democrats and say, here's my list, I'm willing to help you support here, if you'll give a little bit to this and help my supporters. I wanted to kind of go back a little bit to the youth vote mm-hmm. and think about how Joe Biden has been in office for 30, 40 years. They have no idea of what he was saying. And he's not passionate to get that enthusiasm like Sanders has been with all these new ideas. And so I think it will be pressed upon him going forward to think about, how do I message to them? How do I bring this progressivism, but then yet still stay focused on the moderate centrist that we also need to bring into the fold?
And I would venture, too, that's one of the points of conversation we need to have, because there are questions about whether we look at his movement as being much larger than it actually was. So, in hindsight, we're looking at 2018, and a lot of Bernie's candidates really didn't do as well. Moderates did better. The context is different. Back then, we didn't know what President Trump was or what he would, the impact he would have on his party. And there was a substantial number of people who, sad to say, were anti-Hillary. Some of them were, anti-woman, whatever. And they were within the Democratic Party. And this go-round, this election, because there hasn't been a competitive Republican race, it tends to be wider. There are people who are coming over, some of those people who are Republicans that don't really want to affiliate with Trump, a little bit more conservative. So I think there might have been a little bit of an overestimation due to the media focusing so much on Sanders. The other point is, in 2016 and in 2020, Sanders really has benefited from not being attacked that much. You know, most of the attacking that came recently was primarily from Republicans going, look at who we're going to potentially be running against. Socialist. I think that had a potential impact, too.
I was impressed. I was just looking at the results of the most recent Quinnipiac national poll, and they had a question in there where they asked people, would you vote for the nominee if it's Joe Biden against Trump or if it's Bernie Sanders against Trump? And then they broke that down by who people support in the primary. And when you looked at the Sanders supporters, what impressed me, and this was true on both sides, overwhelmingly, yes. So 86% of Sanders supporters said they would vote for Biden. 89% of Biden supporters said they would vote for Sanders. So you're not seeing, and only about 2 or 3% said they'd vote for Trump. So the rest were, you know, third party, would not vote, something like that. So that's indicating, I think the presence of Donald Trump in the White House is the great unifier for Democrats. Coming out of this, I think it's not going to be that hard, actually, to unify the party. It'll take some effort, some gestures, some movement. Biden needs to make some effort in that direction, but I really don't think it's going to be that hard.
And I think that's part of the reason why that speech you heard last night was so toned down. It was so calm. It was so an attempt to at least reach out to the Bernie Sanders supporters, Professor.
Well, I mean, yeah, I would agree. I mean, I would also say that because there wasn't a crowd in the room because of coronavirus, right? I mean, it changes sort of the rhetorical kind of feel of it. And so you're not getting that booing. And even when they tried to recreate it by having the staffers like cheer loudly, like you just can't recreate just having the roar of thousands of people in the room. And I think Biden was able to use that as an opportunity to give a very measured speech to look presidential. But I still say that there's some outreach, right? Because we know that we're dealing with voters who, you know, have different preferences and they might not constrain themselves in the ways that we would in terms of thinking about sort of like what issues go together. So I think, you know, even something simple like if you've got young people who are dealing with massive debt, how do we deal with debt problems, especially stuff that's incurred because of, you know, attempting to get an education? Like that's something that's common ground that I think a lot of people could be able to get behind. And it might, mitigate those who would say, well, I'm mad Bernie didn't get it. And, you know, the economy has been relatively OK under Trump. So I'm either going to sit this out or maybe Trump's not so bad despite his crazy rhetoric. So
I've heard young people say that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. But I don't think that's going to happen to any large degree. I think the student debt issue is an important one for the Biden campaign to use to try to reach out to Sanders supporters. A lot of them are young. A lot of them are dealing with that very issue. The environment is another issue he can reach out to them on, reducing economic inequality. I mean, the things that the issues that Sanders has really made put at the center of his campaign. So I don't think it's going to be that difficult because I don't think in reality they're really as far apart as people think they are.
You know, one of the interesting things about one of the criticisms about Bernie Sanders' campaign was that he essentially gave the same stump speech everywhere he went. He didn't really change. Here and there he changed his message some, but he didn't really pivot. He didn't really take different tacks. Where Joe Biden has, you know, we've seen him reaching out to different segments of the electorate doing this. So I wonder what you guys think about whether or not he'll end up embracing maybe not, you know, free college tuition and things that he's already shut down, but maybe end up embracing other parts of Bernie Sanders' platform.
Yes, I mean, I think he'll move in that direction. He may not. He's not going to embrace everything. He's not going to embrace Medicare for All. But I think he will emphasize that he's open to things like, you know, expanding access to health care through a public option, things like that, which, by the way, is going to be a very heavy lift. It's not going to be easy to get that, let alone Medicare for All, which I think is impossible.
Well, and context matters. So, for example, with some of the cases that are coming up to the courts and, additional sort of conservative attacks on Obamacare, he can shift it. He can be the defender without going all the way towards, Medicaid for All, because he's still going to be the staunchest protector of access to health care.
Right.
I was just going to say, this may be the critical factor of who the vice presidential nominee becomes. Mm. So maybe Biden doesn't do all the outreach to that group, but he allows the VP to be able to speak on that and to carry that message forth.
Can I just get back to the idea of code switching and Sanders' inability to be able to do this? Not that I think it would have actually changed Sanders and Biden's margins among African-American voters in particular, but the decision not just to not go to Mississippi, which I actually completely understand, but the idea to go to Flint and then once you see that the room is white to like change to the speech and not actually talk about race, huge problem, right? If you want to know why Sanders has a hard time with African-American voters, it's because of stuff like that. It's because of not understanding how these issues are issues that everybody should be dealing with, and it's something that you should feel comfortable talking about in different circumstances and in different environments as well. And so, you know, a lot of people kind of poo-poo Joe Biden, and I have too, for not always even for making gaffes and for saying other things. But like this is what being a skilled, seasoned politician gets you the ability to do. It gets you the ability to be able to go into different environments and be able to speak to people and to be able to relate and to empathize. And I think it's really important to kind of point out.
So if you had if you were Bernie Sanders' advisors, what would you have told him to do?
Give the speech. I mean, so it's like this is going to be your moment to make like, you know, a more perfect union speech. So, you know, Obama's speech was given in a room that to me looked like it was just a bunch of reporters. But he was saying things that were important. And granted, he was embodying those in and of itself. But it was like if you went to Flint so that you can talk about structural inequality, go to Flint and talk about structural inequality. Don't just switch it. This just reminds me again that you are a classic progressive who thinks that everything is tied to class and that race and gender and everything else kind of gets subsumed under it. And it's like this is where you had a problem in 2016 and you still are on your learning curve. And that's a problem 4 years later.
One thing that the Sanders campaign did try to do to try to reach out to African-American voters, and we were seeing this here in Georgia, is run a bunch of ads showing Sanders with Obama.
Obama.
Right.
And
mm-hmm.
and as it kind of almost suggested that Obama was endorsing Sanders, I mean, which obviously was not the case. So I thought that was interesting because, of course, Bernie Sanders has had a somewhat fraught relationship with Barack Obama. And actually, at one point, was encouraging a primary challenge to Obama in 2012.
Right.
Unless they had been thinking about it himself, apparently.
And so it was interesting to see that, which obviously was definitely a play to try to expand his appeal among African American voters
little,
in particular.
Too late.
It's gaslighting.
Yeah, and it was incredible. That's right. My husband went, did Barack Obama endorse?
You know, you see this and you say, sure, Obama said some nice things about Bernie Sanders, but you probably could find footage of him saying nice things about lots.
Michael Bloomberg.
Yeah, lots of Democratic candidates.
And Michael
candidates.
Bloomberg played some of the same
things.
He did.
Yeah,
it didn't work in that case either.
No.
I mean, my Republican dad was like, can't Obama like sue and get that enjoined? I was like, if he said it publicly, he doesn't actually own that. They just pulled that from newsreels.
Sure.
So.
Yeah, and look, we've certainly seen Joe Biden do the same, obviously, and he says he's basically going to be the heir to Barack Obama's legacy. Obama has stayed out of the race so far, even though a string of a wave, I should say, of Democratic officials, including here in Georgia, 50 Democratic officials in Georgia came out this morning. Many of them who had supported some of his former rivals, of Joe Biden's former rivals came out. Lucy McBath, who had endorsed Michael Bloomberg, former Governor Roy Barnes. House Minority Leader Bob Trammell, who had endorsed Kamala Harris. So you're seeing if there is still a competitive primary in 2 weeks when Georgia holds the primary, you're seeing the bulk of the Democratic Party establishment now firmly behind Joe Biden.
Sure.
Kamala came out and endorsed him too.
Yes.
I saw that on Instagram.
Sorry, who did?
Kamala Harris.
Oh, Kamala.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Kamala Harris a couple days ago. But here in Georgia, the scales endorsements are there's only about two.
Just about all of the candidates who've dropped out have now endorsed Biden, right?
It's the map ahead for Bernie Sanders. I want to talk about some too because you've got a Sunday debate in front of a zero live audience now because of coronavirus. There's no media filing center or spin room either because of fears of the disease. And then you've got next Tuesday where the map is pretty forbidding to him. These are states like Ohio, Illinois, Florida and Arizona and places where Hillary Clinton did very well and where Bernie Sanders is not expected to do very well.
So here's what I'm actually looking at, particularly in Arizona and Florida. We've seen a divide between blacks and Latinos with respect to their support for Biden and Sanders. So blacks have broken for Joe Biden and Latinos have gone for Bernie Sanders. And I think it's, you know, probably two sides of the same coin. Groups that care about economic inequality but are trying to figure out which one is actually the best one to be able to kind of do this. And I think the question would be for Latino voters, particularly in Arizona, because we could argue that there might be some kind of national origin sort of differences for Latinos in Florida compared to Latinos out west. It would be interesting to see whether or not we see a shift in the Latino vote towards Biden as a result of Biden's momentum. So that's probably the one big thing that I'm paying attention to for next Tuesday.
And I would follow up on that, too, where I think that, you know, I've often tried to measure something called negative momentum. And, you know, when you're losing, you've got someone with some positive momentum. My prediction would be in those races, we might see a lot of those Latino voters that potentially would have gone to Sanders staying home. Because just like at a campaign, I'm sure in the campaign headquarters and in all of those offices, there's this big slump. You know, that's the feeling you get when you work in a campaign and you feel like there's no path forward. So, you know, there's a sort of a backward push.
Yeah. The polling in Arizona has had Biden ahead so far. So, and obviously Latinos are a large chunk of that Democratic vote in Arizona. I haven't seen it broken down that way yet, or I didn't. It's probably there, but I didn't see it. So I would think that Biden is at least getting a substantial share of the Latino vote in Arizona and certainly in Florida, where it is a little bit different.
And if it shifts, I mean, that is exactly what you're saying. That's tough for Sanders.
I don't think it's going to go that far.
The Florida electorate is very interesting, too. So all the past elections, we're seeing this, you know, less than 1% decision making. So, you know, thinking about the primary, yes, is important, but it seems very much that this is Biden's to take. And therefore, what does this look like for the general? Yeah. So are there will we see out of Florida enough enthusiasm from the Democratic voters? Are they turning out to say, yes, even though Biden's the nominee, we're going to come out support him, so we give a clear message that we're anti-Trump, that Florida is different, that they're not going to go back to Trump maybe? I think that will be an interesting play to see next week.
Well, looking ahead to the general election, I think the big story right now is the economy. Mm-hmm. And it's Biden emerging as the Democratic nominee, but really the potential for a significant economic slowdown and possibly a recession in the second quarter, which is actually the most important quarter in terms of shaping voter outlook for the general election. This couldn't happen at a worse time for Trump's reelection campaign.
And we'll talk more about the coronavirus and the economic slowdown in a bit, but it begs the question, how much coronavirus has influenced? Well, we know it's going to influence the campaign trail because major events are being canceled. There's not going to be much campaigning in these states that are holding ballots next week.
And that's fine for Joe Biden.
It's fine for Joe Biden. And even
he does best when he doesn't campaign.
And even President Trump, who is in Atlanta on Friday, saying that, hey, you know, my supporters still like major rallies. Well, Vice President Pence, who's in charge of his coronavirus task force, says, yeah, we're going to take these on a case-by-case basis. Yes.
Oh, I was going to say, too, you know, since we're talking about general election strategy, you know, one of the things I think that Biden really has to focus on is, hey, I got a team. I got a lot of competent people. We got problems. You know, Trump has all these people with no experience that came in, and look what happened. Yeah. I'm bringing in the A team.
Right. Oh, yeah. I think that's it's a perfect issue for him.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's get a quick break out of the way, because when we come back, I want to talk about how this is going to impact Georgia's primary. And if it was a little short-sighted to schedule the primary after 3 weeks after Super Tuesday. You're listening to Political Rewind on GPB. We're back in 1 minute. Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Greg Bluestein, filling in today for the great Bill Nygut. We are joined today by Dr. Andra Gillespie, Dr. Audrey Haynes, Dr. Karen Owen, and Dr. Alan Arabowitz. Thanks for joining us. So, as promised, we'll talk a little bit about whether or not Georgia's March 24th primary is a little bit anticlimactic now. There might not even be a competitive race by 2 weeks from now. So did Georgia make a mistake by scheduling the primary March 24th? Of course, we're usually Super Tuesday. And 4 years ago, it was actually dubbed the SEC primary because so many southern states were in the same contest. And now we're not necessarily going to be quite the decision maker, are we, Professor?
Yeah. I mean, again, you know, but there are so many factors kind of filling into this that, you know, I can't say that I begrudge the decision to go later in the month. So, you know, we're bringing new voting machines online. And so if anything goes wrong, you know, we will be thankful that we don't have all the, you know, sort of the attention that we would have gotten on Super Tuesday happening at that particular moment. Also, I think it's important to kind of keep in mind, based on what I last saw this morning, Joe Biden has about 750 delegates so far. So he's not even halfway there. So, yeah, even if it's anticlimactic at this point, whatever he gets from Georgia goes towards what his overall delegate count is. So it's not actually officially over by the time we get to March 24th. It's well into April before he hits 1991.
Yeah.
And so I think we just kind of have to keep this in perspective. There were other issues other than sort of like whether or not we get to kind of go to the big dance. We will get our turn and we should all still participate.
Oh, you never know. I mean, making those decisions is tough. If it had continued to be competitive, we could have been, you know, a very important state with lots of money pouring in to our media system. But, you know, that's the nature of campaigns. Yeah. Who would have predicted that you would have had? We wouldn't have. Did we see this coming? All of those people dropping out and sort of coalescing around one candidate. It was amazing.
Well, I think after South Carolina, it was pretty obvious that Joe Biden was likely to win Georgia big.
Mm-hmm. But not until that point. We thought
it wasn't as clear until South Carolina. I think I still would have probably said that's what I would expect. But then it became very clear. But the other thing I would say is that March 24th really isn't late if you think about the calendar. I mean, it's just we've gotten so used to the idea that the calendar is so front loaded that, you know, that we expect the all the important contests to take place in the first 6 or 8 weeks after the primaries begin, and that's kind of a crazy system, and you know there have been other recent contests where it did go all the way to the end. In 2008, in 2016, it really wasn't settled until Hillary Clinton clearly had the lead, but it wasn't settled until the
June.
Convention really.
Yeah, I mean until June of 2016.
So you never know.
Recently with all the competition we've had.
Well, that was the thought. Yeah. You know, a lot of people were talking about the possibility of a so-called brokered convention or at least a multi-ballot convention only 2 weeks ago.
Yes.
The 538 model had that as the most likely
the insurmountable
outcome.
Bernie
and,
Sanders
and
lead.
In a week or 10 days, it flipped to now it's like a 99% chance that Biden is the nominee.
So I want to talk about that, Professor, because, you know, what South Carolina in the South really shaped this race.
Indeed. And I think for Biden, it was his, you know, if I don't succeed in South Carolina, then what was his path forward? And then he did mobilize and energize and get excited. And South Carolina shaped then where we've been sitting. And I, you know, Alan can probably fill me in more here, but I believe historically the South played the role for Super Tuesday. That's why we had Super
Tuesday. Well, that's why it came about.
About like in 88, was it in 88?
In 88, although in 88 it didn't work out the way the people.
Yes, Southern strategy.
No, it was Jesse Jackson and Michael Dukakis won most of the Southern primaries. But after that, in 92 it helped Bill Clinton certainly.
And so we're looking at 2020, right? That Super Tuesday is not the SEC. It went around the country. And so interesting, I think, too, that, you know, in South Carolina, Biden got the momentum and he went forward for those other states. Well, Georgia, and I think we're all talking right now as if it's locked in for Biden, but we don't know that Sanders is definitely out.
No.
And if he decided to just stay in and see, because he knows there's a lot of delegates still there, he may feel
and
a little...
And
he has the money to go on.
Cash,
he can keep raising money. But I was going to say the key here, though, is yes, it's the South, but the reason the South was so huge for Joe Biden was African-American voters. And that's why South Carolina was his firewall. It was the African-American vote in South Carolina. Yes, he won the white vote in South Carolina also, but he won the African-American vote overwhelmingly. He won it overwhelmingly on Super Tuesday. He won it overwhelmingly again yesterday. Mm-hmm. And Bernie Sanders' inability to really make any significant inroads among African-American voters is, I think, the single most important reason for his downfall in 2020.
And not to raise the number of his targeted progressive young voters to the levels that were anticipated, because they did not turn out in the numbers that...
It was not realistic, I think, to think that they would.
Well, yeah, I mean, I completely agree with that. I mean, and I hate, Alan and I both teach the introductory American politics class. And so when you get to political participation, you have to tell your students that they're kind of flaky and that they don't vote.
I think our students do, but.
Yeah.
They just vote in New York.
But, you know, I think the hard thing is, you know, is that Iowa looked very differently. I mean, a quarter of the caucus goers in Iowa were young, and that has just not been the case anyplace else.
That's exactly the point I was going to make. Iowa is the only state so far that we know of where youth participation was actually up, where every other state youth participation has been down. And one of the interesting things about last night, too, was that Joe Biden, obviously he did really well with African-American voters, but he started winning small town. He started winning suburbs in
white
in major
working class
ways.
Voters.
And there were some states in Michigan, I think if he didn't sweep every county, he won almost every county.
Every county.
Yeah, so he ended up winning every county.
Every county.
Idaho, he wins. You know, this is a state where Bernie Sanders was expected to do very well.
And turnout was very high in Michigan. I'm not sure about the other states, but turnout was very high and much higher than 4 years ago.
If we bring it back to Georgia, though, I was just thinking, if it is pretty much now a Biden contest, will the African-American voters turn out? Will they be excited to actually come to the presidential primary, cast that ballot? Will they be mobilized? Will they be energized to do that since they'll think this is the presumptive nominee?
I wanted to get
– I was just going to say, you know, because our counties make a difference. So here will we see within Cobb County, Gwinnett County, where they have been trending much more blue, will those voters be there to show for that general election strategy that, yes, he can, you know, energize – those members and those communities and flip some of them still, right?
Yep. Well,
and they may not think it really – I mean, you know, it really depends on what people are thinking because there's not a lot going on March 24th, right?
No.
And so it may
there's
be one of those things –
There's nothing else going on but the presidential primary, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah, the
state
primaries are May 19th,
yeah,
19th. Or something like that.
Yeah. So you know, if the feeling is – and they're hearing it's over, and unless somebody is really pushing – people to come out to vote, I expect that our turnout's going to be pretty
That's high. What I don't think if Sanders ends his campaign, certainly I don't think we're going to have a very high turnout in our primary, but I don't think that means much about what the turnout's going to look like in the fall.
No.
I mean,
I
think
not
it's going to be
a
very high turnout election in this fall.
I mean, and what I would tell the DPG, and I'm pretty sure Nikema Williams is doing this, is, you know, primaries are always kind of dress rehearsals for your GOTV strategy. So this state is trying to make the case that they're on the map and that we're going to be competitive in 2020. So you demonstrate that by making sure that you get people to turn out in primaries. So I'm pretty sure that the DPG is doing the things that it needs to do so that it can show a robust turnout.
Well, and I think having Joe Biden at the top of the ticket is going to reassure a lot of Democrats in this state. They did not want Bernie Sanders at the top of the ticket going into the fall election.
I was just going to say, and going forward for 2022, you know, the next cycles, will Georgia then be talked about to be moved up into those contests first, not the Iowa, you know, coming to more diverse states?
And what did Stacey Abrams, most prominent Democrat in Georgia, say? She said that there should no longer be a parade to Iowa and Nevada and New Hampshire and South Carolina. There should be more of a regional primary or a national primary. And I want to stay on that topic because something you said earlier, Dr. Owen, where you mentioned how the vice presidential nominee could play a really big role. Of course, we've got not just Stacey Abrams being mentioned here, but Sally Yates was also talked about in a New York Times article this week as a potential VP nominee. What effect do you think that could have on whoever the nominee is? I'm not saying either one of those two Georgians, but could have on uniting the party as Democrats go forward?
So I think, and obviously each of us can talk about this, it's very important strategically who Biden chooses. And I think he's got to think about the voters he definitely wants to unite and bring in. And part of that is, you know, a lot of discussion has been about an African-American female, how that would be really great, Stacey Abrams' name at the top. But I think it's very important that he think about those female voters, and it could be just another woman. I think one thing that I have been reading and really focused on is his age and health. Mm-hmm. So does he pick someone who is very young or, you know, maybe a mid-50s or, you know, something, but someone who can obviously take the mantle if needed, and someone who has experience. So do you want someone who has legislative experience? Do you want someone who has administrative experience? Someone who can bring that to the table with you so, you can lead forward your administration if necessary.
This is an election where I think the vice presidential pick will have more importance than usual. Mm-hmm. I mean, it normally does not make mm-hmm. much difference. But in this case, given Biden's age and given the need for him to try to reach out to the progressive wing of the party and also to probably balance the ticket with a woman, I think that who he picks will be very important. And so, yes, someone younger, almost certainly a woman, possibly a minority. Most importantly, I think this has to be someone who is a credible president, someone who could be seen as someone who would be capable of stepping into that job without a lot of on-the-job training.
Yeah, I mean, and to kind of, you know, the one time in recent history that we think the vice presidential sort of nomination actually mattered would be in 2008. And for the exact same reasons that we're talking about here, John McCain was actually, you know, in his early 70s at that point. But given his history of cancer, it was like, oh, yeah, we have to have somebody who can step in. And when Sarah Palin had those disastrous interviews mm-hmm. on CBS and ABC, right, that didn't give people a whole lot of confidence. So I think that, you know, that has to be an issue regardless of, you know, who the nominee is. And then there are also these other sort of, you know, demographic kind of like, you know, tensions that have to be addressed. And so, I mean, I just think it's impossible to think that there's going to be like, you know, a white guy who would sort of be able to, especially a straight white guy who could actually sort of be Joe Biden's running mate.
Yeah, or it won't be Steve Bullock.
Like Tim Kaine.
Yeah,
you
know. it would not happen this time.
I don't think
impossible.
So. And I think he's suggested that he's looking at some of his former rivals mm-hmm, mm-hmm. also. And so I think someone like, you know, Kamala Harris, Amy Klobuchar, Elizabeth Warren, I think, might be, except for the fact that, I mean, there's
she's
the issue
old.
That she's too liberal. But more of an issue, I think, is that or if she'd have to be replaced by a Republican appointee. Mm.
So what of Stacey Abrams? I just want to get you guys hunches because there's probably no prospective VP who's gotten more headlines than her because every event she's asked about it, and she's very open about it, how she wants to be president one day, but she's very willing to be a vice president. And so every time she says that, there's 15,000 more headlines about it. Do you think that someone who hasn't endorsed, because this is interesting, she said multiple times she will not endorse. Do you think someone who isn't endorsing Joe Biden could be his running mate?
I mean, that actually could give her an extra air of credibility. I mean, I think part of the reason why Stacey Abrams is a strong candidate is because she is somebody who in some ways is like a cipher for many different camps within the Democratic coalition. So, you know, she certainly sort of checks off the descriptive boxes in terms of her race and gender. But, you know, she is somebody who could be embraced by moderates. And she's somebody who could be embraced by progressives. And not many people could kind of straddle and bridge those worlds and be fully embraced by everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think about, you know, since I know Stacey used to be my state rep. And, you know, I think about Cory Booker, who I wrote a book about. You know, when I think about sort of like what, you know, his strengths are relative to hers, you know, he is firmly in the moderate camp. You know, and you know, has some progressive viewpoints, but is strictly viewed mm-hmm. as being sort of a moderate. That's really hard to pair up with a Joe Biden. On the other hand, yeah, Stacey Abrams could cut deals with Republicans here in the state house, but as a gubernatorial candidate, she was viewed as a progressive just given the context in which she was running.
Yeah.
So it makes her a really, really attractive VP candidate.
I agree, and I certainly think she could be she's in the running here. But on the other hand, I think the weakness that she has is, I think, this idea that is she really ready to be president, given that her own political experience is quite limited. I mean, her highest level office was as a party leader and a minority party leader in the State House of Representatives. You know, that's not quite on a par with some of these other potential vice presidential picks that we're talking about. And that doesn't rule her out. But, I mean, I think that does probably count against her somewhat.
It's fair, but, I mean, she's not going to get on TV and say that she, you know, that, you know, that Alaskans can see Russia from their houses. I mean, so she's not going to have those types of problems. So, yeah, I mean, yes, it is a disadvantage. On the other hand, right, it's something that she thinks that she can overcome.
So that's something that we know that she can get out there and she would be a very strong campaigner for the ticket.
I would love to do an experiment, too, because one of the things that happens to Stacey Abrams is when people know her, when they're listening to her, they take all the stuff from the gubernatorial election and they're resistant to her message. They don't hear it. They just see liberal. But if you take one of her speeches and you have students listen to it, they're like, who is that? man, those are such good ideas. Totally different response without the label and sadly without being associated with the campaign.
I was just going to quickly add that I think interesting is, will she actually get in the headlines more in the next week or two? She's, you know, been not front and center, not making the endorsements like Kamala Harris or, you know, Amy Klobuchar coming out and kind of people seeing them and their support for Biden. So will she kind of start in the next week or two saying, yes, this is going to be our nominee and I'm supporting of this and catching more national buzz?
Perfect segue. I'm glad you said that because she just made some Georgia news that we'll talk about after the break. Let's get that second break out of the way. Coming up, we're going to talk about coronavirus in Georgia. You're listening to Political Rewind on GPB. We're back in 1 minute. Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Greg Bluestein, filling in today for the great Bill Nygut. Mm-hmm. We're joined today by Dr. Andra Gillespie, Dr. Audrey Haynes, Dr. Karen Owen, and Dr. It's a lot of doctors, Alan Abramowitz, and the non-doctor Greg Bluestein, although my dad was. So as I promised, we'll talk about coronavirus. We had a lot of developments last night. Late last night, Governor Kemp's office reported there are now 6 confirmed cases, 16 presumptive positives in Georgia. Most are in metro Atlanta, but we now have our first reported case south of the city in the small rural county of Charlton, where their hospital recently closed. New this morning, Grand Princess cruise ship passengers, about 34 Georgians and dozens of others, arrived at Dobbins. The Hard Labor Creek State Park emergency facility opened with its first patient from Georgia. Schools remain closed in Fulton County. Valdosta City Schools closed today as well. And a group of a coalition of five left-leaning groups, including Fair Fight Action, Stacey Abrams Group, called on Governor Kemp and legislative leaders to shut down the Capitol and delay crossover day, which is scheduled for tomorrow, because of coronavirus concerns. And this came hours after Speaker Ralston urged the public to stay home rather than join the jumble under the Gold Dome because of concerns about spreading the illness. So what's going on? Anyone like to jump in?
Well, I was just thinking, you know, there is concern. People are not sure, you know, the people who have been tested positive or if there's others who don't have symptoms yet and they are in public places and what's going on. As far as, you know, government goes, that kind of goes against our whole open and transparency and government sunshine. So having these meetings leading up to crossover day is very important that the public can be engaged. And I mean, as professors, we have interns who are at the Capitol, and I'm just thinking about going to visit them and then having the kind of concern of, do I really want to walk in? How many people are there? How many children are coming through on field trips? I mean, there's a lot to consider here.
I should mention the House suspended its teenage page program. The Senate did not. So you're hearing a little bit mixed message. On one hand, Speaker Ralston saying we're not going to have a page program, urging folks to stay home, no special guests. On the other hand, the Senate says it's business as usual.
Yeah, I wonder how long that's going to last, though. I mean, I think the proposal to delay crossover day and postpone the session it's not unreasonable. I doubt if it's going to happen. But we're seeing colleges and universities across the country are now shutting down or going into online, it's going toward online classes. That's happening at a lot of schools, and it hasn't happened yet at Emory, but I think we're moving in that direction. And we're on spring break right now. The students should be coming back on Monday. I won't be surprised if we end up moving in that direction. We're already being offered training in using online tools for teaching, which is something that it's not as easy as it sounds. You know, I think if you haven't done it, and I haven't done it, and so it's going to be very challenging, I think, for a lot of us.
Having done it for multiple years and started it, you know, in my department, I'll tell you, it is challenging. My one piece of advice is you can always stay a week or two ahead of your students. So it's not so bad in that respect. I was going to say, too, that, you know, we've moved to a period where we're trying to really mitigate the spread. And it is a little worrisome when you do get mixed messages coming out there. I mean, Kemp has gotten really good marks for coming out and providing information, but it may be that we need to see more collective effort of everybody mm-hmm. working together to solve the problem. Because obviously the fact that we don't have testing kits, that people right. can't get tested, they can't find out where the source is and how it spread, those are very worrisome, and we lost a lot of time. I know President Trump likes to take credit for making a good decision about, you know, closing access to the U.S. from places like China that were coming in and doing that. But in that interim time period, we had some really difficult times getting those testing kits out. We lost a good month of response time.
Yep. And certainly, you'd have to say the messages coming out of the Trump White House have been mixed.
Extremely.
The president is often seems to be contradicting what we're hearing from his own, you know, his own experts, from the vice president. Certainly, what we're hearing from the public health experts. So that's been part of the problem. And then we're also looking now, I think, at some pretty serious economic consequences from this. And it remains to be seen what is going to be done in response to that. The information that we heard yesterday coming out of the White House was they're going to do something, but it was pretty vague. It's clear that they're a long way from having any kind of real proposal.
And no agreement.
And they're having a hard time coming to agreement about that. And you know, I think it's going to be difficult to come up with something that will be acceptable to the White House, to congressional Republicans, to the Democrats. But I think there's an urgent need at this point. I mean, certainly the economic experts at this point are saying, you know, we really need to see some kind of big stimulus package to try to offset the effects that we see coming here.
So far, we're hearing its focus, the Trump plan will be focused on a payroll tax holiday along with federal help for workers who don't have paid sick leave. But Democrats argue that cutting the federal payroll tax would not help people who've lost their jobs in this sudden downturn.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I just question sort of the use of tax cuts as stimulus, because it isn't an issue of mm-hmm. needing to get me to spend more money. I mean, there's a supply chain problem. And then there is the structural problem of people who are being pushed out of work because, like, you know, people are taking fewer services, or because they're sick and they need to stay home, or they need to be quarantined or isolated. And so I wish that the solutions would actually address that big structural issue of we don't have paid, like, mandatory paid sick leave, mm-hmm. or what kind of help can you give to small businesses so that they can offer that to their workers. That would strike me as much more effective than telling me yep. that I don't have to pay FICA taxes for a little
and,
bit.
And we still have millions of people who do not have health insurance. And so the question is, what happens when they get sick? You know, and are they going to end up in emergency rooms, and who's going to pay the bill for that?
And look, we've seen the coronavirus specter play out large on the Georgia campaign trail here too. I was at Kelly Loeffler's event with Senator Loeffler's event with Nikki Haley on Monday. 400 people crammed into a very tight space, and I couldn't help the feeling that in 2 weeks this is not going to happen.
No, nope.
You know, those events won't happen again. At the Capitol now, the preferred means of contact are no longer handshakes or hugs. It's now elbow taps or even like foot taps. So things are changing there. And Congressman Doug Collins, as we talked about in the show before, had to go into self-quarantine. Last night, he turned his self-quarantine into a campaign event. He did interviews with most of the TV stations around the nation, around the state, I should say, went on Fox News and held a Facebook Live where he took questions from his supporters and basically went on the attack on Senator Loeffler. So it's playing out here in a major way.
Well, I'm wondering if we're going to see so we were talking about the transition to online classes. I mean, how much infrastructure do we have for servers? I mean, how well are we going to be able to maintain that type of, you know, usage? I mean, we don't know. I mean, I think this virus is going to show us areas where we are not doing as well. And it'll be interesting if Biden takes the fact that the Trump administration cut out the, you know, sort of the pandemic response team from the CDC and all those things, and how that is manifesting now.
So the University of West Georgia, like many other of the state universities, are really focused on, you know, paying attention to the CDC's guidelines and the Georgia Department of Health. But I had a student yesterday who said, great, we go online if we have to in 2 weeks or something. What about the student who doesn't have a laptop? Mm-hmm. Like, I can't do all my coursework off my phone. And yep. is the university going to provide a way for us to have access to a lab, to a library computer or something, but be isolated for us? I mean, there's a lot of questions about how this could potentially play out. And I think our students don't know. I mean, like, faculty are trying to figure it out, but they're also trying to figure out, too, where they're going to stand.
Yeah, and let alone, you know, students who are worried about symptoms, you know, even if they don't have the virus, and hopefully they don't, but symptoms and where they can go to get help. It's going to be
Capacity. They're talking about the way our healthcare systems and our hospitals. We just mentioned a hospital that is
in
closed.
Charlton County, yeah.
We don't have enough beds, and we don't have enough respirators. And you know, we're seeing what you know. They talk about most of what we know about treatment, and especially in relation to an epidemic, comes from studies of flu. And you have these you know these curves. And the good news coming out of China is we see their downturn. So they're in that process of the curve coming down. But look at Italy. That's the news that was so frightening this morning. It's like exploded. So we really don't know what our curve is going to be, and we don't know how many lives we can save because we don't have enough respirators and we don't have enough hospital beds. Where is the government responding? Because that is really the role of government, right?
And I think it's likely as the number of test kits does increase, and we're seeing that happen, and more people do get tested, that we're going to see a rapid increase in the number of people who have been diagnosed.
And Trump will not be happy with those numbers.
And he will not be happy.
But, I mean, you know, I mean, one, it's expected. And two, you know, especially when he said this last week at the CDC, I want to keep my numbers low. It's like, no, we're not trying to keep our numbers low. Like, this isn't about optics and PR. It's about actually trying to get closer to a true number. Right?
It's not about your numbers until you know exactly what it is.
Exactly.
Well, we got to leave it there, but we will be talking a lot about this in the next couple of weeks. That will do it for today's Political Rewind. I would like to thank our guests, Dr. Andra Gillespie, Dr. Audrey Haynes, Dr. Karen Owen, and Dr. Alan Abramowitz. Thank you for listening. And remember, if you missed any part of the show or if you liked it so much that you want to listen again, find it on gppnews.org.